Shabbat Shalom. Again, with the crying. Telling Mark and Tammy last night, I don't think I've ever been here where I haven't cried. Y'all find some way to make me cry. And today's no exception. And I went from crying to smiling just a moment ago. Some of the first memories I have, ever, are my dad in his room playing his Hank Williams records. So one of the first songs I ever heard in my whole life was I Saw the Light. Now, granted, not quite that way. I smiled because I had an image of my dad sitting in the back getting all perked up when he started singing I Saw the Light and then throw him a curveball with some words he hasn't heard before. So, but anyway, that was great. So I've gone from crying to smiling, and that's one of the reasons that I and my family always enjoy being here, you know. Yeah, I get to speak, but really the reason we come is not for me to speak. It's so that we can be refreshed and that we can be rejuvenated. And really, you guys are like, as far as we're concerned, from our point of view, you're like a field hospital. You know, sometimes we just want to come over here and get patched up, cry a little bit, have our confidence in people restored. I'll be honest with you. I have the utmost respect and admiration for Mark and Tammy and their leadership here. And, it's just, I want to say this the right way. When people can take a stand for what is right, knowing that it's going to cost them relationships. When people can dance or hold the chuppah after they've just buried one of their babies, they can do that. That says something for what the Creator is doing in this congregation and through the people here. And so, speaking for Beth and myself, well, we just need to see that every once in a while. And so we so appreciate you. And oddly enough, when I woke up this morning, I had that same passage in Isaiah on my mind. It was just kind of in my head, you know. And I can't say that really knew why, but I want to go back and read a little bit of that Tammy read from Isaiah this morning. From Isaiah chapter 51, and maybe address a couple of things that she didn't get into. But verse 1 says, "Listen to me, you who follow after righteousness, you who seek the Lord. Look to the rock from which you were hewn, and to the hole of the pit from which you were dug. Look to Abraham your father, and to Sarah who bore you. For I called him alone, and blessed him, and increased him." And then he goes on to talk about how he will comfort Zion. And when I've read that in times past, I've thought of different things. But the thing that struck me this morning is that in our journeys, in our walk, in our lives, we're all going to encounter things. And sometimes we falter. Sometimes we come up short. And it's at least for me, it's easy for me to see my flaws and my warts and my shortcomings through the eyes of a person who has this long history in his family of people full of warts and flaws. You know, I come from a long line of heathens. Okay? So it's easy to see, you know, to amplify, I guess you'd say, those imperfections and those shortcomings. But then when I read this, I'm reminded that 20-some-odd years ago, or close to 30 years ago now, I was brought into another family. All things that were old, they passed away. All things became new. And so when I look to that hole of the pit from which I was dug, I look to Abraham, my father, and I should be reminded that as the seed of Abraham in Messiah, that the same one who called him called me. The same one who called him called you. And that in that I see that there is always the hope. There is always that potential to overcome, to be the person that he's called us to be in spite of all of the things that we have to go through. And so I wanted to read just a little bit past where Tammy read. Verse 6, lift up your eyes to the heavens and look on the earth beneath, for the heavens will vanish away like smoke. The earth will grow old like a garment, and those who dwell in it will die in like manner. But my salvation will be forever, and my righteousness will not be abolished. The theme that I picked up on this morning, I don't know if you did or not, but the theme I picked up on is life happens, but he's eternal. We come, we go, but he remains. And so as we journey through life, we should focus upon those things that are eternal. We should exhibit those things that are eternal. Because one day, we'll pass away. But we can leave something that is eternal in our children and our grandchildren, something that can be propagated through this earth. And so he uses us to promote and to propagate those things that are eternal, in spite of our temporal imperfections. She mentioned the fact that you took 13 stones. I got it that that wasn't planned, but that just turned out to be the way it was. You put 13 stones on there because, and that, those stones are God created. They represent those things that are sustained, those things that are eternal. And I'm sure you know this, but just in case some of you may not be aware of this, 13 not only is the number of the tribes, but 13 is the value of the word Ahava, love. It's the word for love. It's also the value of the word Echad, the word for one. And seeing that he told us to listen, hear, I'm speaking to you. And at the end of that, he's one. He is the one. And so if you take those two together, the one who exhibits love, who is love, and you put those two words together, the value is 26. And that is equivalent to Yud-Heh, Vav-Heh, because he is eternal. And so in our life, we pursue him. We pursue those things that emanate from him. We exhibit those things. We are called to exhibit those things that are eternal. I'm getting older, less hair, and what hair I have is grayer, and I've got a little padding around the middle now. And I know that I have more days behind me than I do in front of me. But with the breath that he has given us, we are to, as we journey through this life, to exhibit those things that are eternal. So with that in mind, I want to go over to part of our Torah portion. And I do this, and I want to confess to you that I honestly not really certain what I have that can add to what he's already said and already spoken. But I will share with you those things that I feel like he's placed on my heart. But in the Torah portion, that's called Ekev, in Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 1, Moses speaks and says, every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to guard, to literally protect, to observe. Why? That you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And so the objective is, as far as the people of God in this context, and it is also applicable to us, the whole idea here is to get to the promised land, to inhabit the land that he has set apart for his people, and that ultimately looking forward to the time that he dwells among his people, and that we dwell with him in that new Jerusalem. That's the ultimate objective. That's where everything is headed. But there is a journey to get there. And on the way, we have to be careful to guard those things that he's entrusted to us, to guard those things that he's placed inside of, those things that are not temporal, but those things that are eternal, those things that will sustain, those things that will deliver, those things that redeem. Those are the things that we are to protect. Those are the things that we are to internalize so that we will live that we will multiply, that we will propagate these things, that we will leave these things living in our children and our grandchildren for future generations, and so that we will all possess the land which the Lord has sworn to our fathers. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and to nasa, to test you, to prove you. To prove what? To know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. I don't want, you know, I want to be really sensitive to what you're going through as a congregation, what the Mervins are going through as a family, and what others are going through that maybe we don't even know about. But it strengthens and it encourages others like myself when people are going through, in what is my view, the hardest test a human being can ever go through in this life. To see you holding that chuppah, to see you dancing with that banner. Because if you can do that, then what's my excuse? You know, what's my excuse? And so he humbles us. He puts us in situations. And unfortunately, for some, we're not put in that kind of a test. But whatever the test is, whatever the environment is, whatever the situation is, he knows how to push all of our buttons. He knows what to do to put us in that situation to prove us whether it's really in your heart to do what I want you to do. The word was given. He's not looking for people who come in here every Sabbath, sing, shout, dance, go home, and then do what they want to do. He's looking for those people that have it in their heart to follow him, to do his commandments even when it's not convenient to do, to keep his commandments even when they really perhaps are facing situations they'd rather just curl up into a ball and die. So he humbles you, and he proves you. Nasa, it's test is the word that it's used here. I prefer the word to prove because in my mind there's a little bit of a difference between going through a test and being proven. When I was in school or when we were all in school, we studied subjects, history, math, whatever it was, and then every 2 weeks or 3 weeks we have to go in and take a test to see what of the information we have retained, what is it we're struggling with, and so the teacher helps us to go on and to improve in that regard. But when it comes to being proven, the story I've always used for my life is when I was going into my senior year of high school, played football, believe it or not, I played on the line. We had a small school, so it didn't have a lot of options. But anyway, I was accustomed to playing on the line, but in summer camp going into my senior year of high school, the coach came to me and he said, "All right, Cloud, I want you to play linebacker this year." And he didn't ask me if I wanted to do it. He told me I was going to do it. And I was really uncertain about it. I didn't feel like I could do it. And I said, "You know, coach, I don't think I'm comfortable with that. I don't think I know how to do that." And he said, "I didn't ask you if you wanted to. I'm telling you, you're going to do it." And so the long and the short of it is he put me in that position not to see whether or not I could do it, but for me to realize that I could do it, to prove me. So I think there's a distinction in being tested in something and being proven in a situation. We get into situations sometimes we didn't ask for, we didn't want, would rather just avoid altogether. But he knows what he's doing. Because he's the eternal one, and he puts us in situations to prove us, to demonstrate to ourselves and those who are watching you that he puts us in situations and he proves that in him we can do these things, we can walk through these things, we can overcome these things, we can finish this journey as long as we are pursuing those things that are eternal. So he humbled you. He allowed you to hunger. That Hebrew word literally means famine. He allowed you to feel the pangs of hunger. And then he fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know. And from that, I've always gleaned that he gives me what I need, not necessarily what I want. Because when I hear the manna described, even though it's kind of miraculous in how it gets to your plate, it doesn't seem all of that interesting in terms of taste and appearance. It's kind of bland in that respect. But he gives us what we need. He gives us our daily bread, not what we want necessarily, but what we need. Because once again, he is the eternal one, and through his people, he wants to propagate those things that are eternal. And so he causes us to come into these situations where we are proven, where we are humbled, where we feel the pangs of hunger. And in terms of temporal things, lack. And then he feeds us what we need. And so I gave you that bread that you didn't know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. And he goes on from there to talk about how your garments didn't wear out, your foot didn't swell, and you should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord God chastens you. Therefore, you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and to fear him. The title of this particular Torah portion is called Ekev. It begins in Deuteronomy 7 in verse 12, which says, "Then it shall come to pass because you listen to these judgments and keep and do them, that the Lord your God will keep you with the covenant and the mercy which he swore to your fathers, and he will love you and bless you and multiply you," etc. But the word that is because is the word that is ekev, as a result of you listening to these judgments, keeping them and doing them. Here are the things that are going to be rewarded to you. These are the things that are going to come upon you because, as a result of you walking in these things. And so the word ekev, translated because, interestingly, that's the word for heel. H-E-E-L. And so the idea in my mind is this. Because I'm walking, putting my heel and the other heel, one foot in front of the other, walking the path that he has prepared for me, the steps of a good man are ordered of the Lord. The steps of a tzaddik, the steps of a righteous one. Now, frankly, some of those steps I don't particularly care for. Some I would have rather gone a different way, not gone through certain things. But the steps of a good man are ordered of him because they are going to bring us to our good. They are going to bring us ultimately into that place that he wants us to be, so that he can work in us and through us and influence others to propagate those things that are eternal. And so we put our heel down on that step. And really, I'm just following in the impressions that another heel has already left before me. Because as his disciple, I am told to take up your cross and follow me. And so as I'm taking up that cross or that execution stake or stavros or whatever word works for you, as we take that and represents our laying down of our life, self-denial, saying no to self, we're not just wandering. We're actually following in the impressions that his heel has already left. And so I take my ekev and I put it where his ekev was. I take my heel and I put it in the impression that his heel has already left before me, because he's not going to ask me, you, anyone in this room to do something that he hasn't already done. So, we're on this journey. And this journey to be perfected requires destruction. In fact, in Hebrew, the two concepts are connected. They go hand in glove. You can't have perfection unless there's first destruction. The idea here would be that, first of all, my will, my wants, my desires have to die. They have to be destroyed if I'm going to be perfected. things have to collapse in order for things to be restored. My will, my desire, my wants, how I'd rather have it, has to collapse if what he wants and what he has willed is going to be restored. And so this part of this Torah portion, at least as far as I'm concerned, speaks to that issue. As we're walking this path that he has set before us, and we're dying to our will, and his will is growing in us, that also means this, that all the obstacles, all the impediments, all the things that stand against his will, guess what? He will use us to cause those things to collapse. David is a picture of the Messiah, right? Messiah is called Son of David. What's David most famous for? What's the first thing you ever heard about David? Goliath, all right? So he goes out to fight Goliath. Goliath in Hebrew. Goliath in Hebrew is a family word with galut. Do you know what that word means? Exile. And so when David goes out to fight Goliath, it is a picture of the Messiah ending the exile. And what is the exile about? It's about the nations putting their heel on God's people. In fact, if you read the rest of Isaiah 51, he refers to the fact that his people have kind of laid down and the nations are just wanting to walk all over them. So the idea of the galut in Goliath is the nations trampling his people. And so one day the Messiah is going to come and he is going to end the exile, right? What did David use? He picked up a stone. Okay, in other words, David used you know, those stones that from that hole of the pit that you were hewn out of. He picked up a stone and put it in his sling, and he put that between the eyes of the giant, of the that represents the exile, to bring him down. Yeah, and then he went up and cut his head off. But my point is, he uses us to advance his purposes, and so amplifying the fact that we have to continue to walk in the footprints that he has set before us. And I know you know all this stuff. I know that you already have all these things, but this is kind of what's on my heart today. I want to backtrack in the Torah just a little bit to Numbers chapter 33, another Torah portion. We read it a couple of weeks ago. Masai. It's well, you'll have to just kind of trust me on this, but it's in Hebrew, it's Mem Samech Ayin Yud, Masai. And the root word, Mem Samech Ayin Masai, is actually a related term to the word we mentioned in Deuteronomy chapter 8 just a moment ago, to prove. Nasa. It's related. Now, why is it called Masai? Because it's translated journeys. These are the journeys. Some render it, and this is actually better, these are the stages. These are the stages or the stations. And so as we go through Numbers 33, what we find is there are all these stages or all these stations from the time that Israel left Egypt until the time they entered into the land. There were 42 stations, 42 stages that they had to go through before they entered into the land. Now, we'll look at the names of the camps and we'll go, well, they camped here, then they moved there, then they moved there. And the word Masai, journey or stages, actually implies pulling up a tent peg. You pull up the tent peg and you move the camp. Why? Because the pillar of the cloud or the pillar of the fire is moving on now. But as you go through that, and I'll kind of condense this, there's a lot of dramatic things that happen in the very first few of those stages. And there are some very dramatic things that happen at the last few of those stages. But a lot of the in-between, it's not even recorded what happened. It's just life. Just dealing with life. And at the beginning of it, some very miraculous things happened that really, they were just kind of there watching. They didn't make it happen. You know, they're there assembled at the sea. Pharaoh's pursuing them from behind, and Moses raises that rod, and the breath of God splits open the sea, so they walk through on dry land. I mean, they're just there. I'm going with the flow here. Because he did it because he's eternal, and he had a reason for bringing his people to that point. But he set them on this journey. Some of the things that happened along the way came as a result of bad choices. Some of the things that happened, they could have avoided. But all of it is to say that these different encampments shouldn't just be viewed as they were changing scenery. There was a change that was to be provoked in their lives. He moved them from place to place to place, to stage to stage to stage, from station to station, not just to change their scenery, but to provoke a change in their hearts. We get bored pretty easily. Familiarity breeds contempt, is the old saying. And we get bored, and so we want a change of scenery. My opinion, a lot of people 20 years ago came to the Hebrew Roots movement because it was a change of scenery. Look around. Can you find all of those people that started out with you 20 years ago? No, because some people look at it as just a change of scenery. And that's all it is. And so they get bored and they're looking for something else that's different or makes me look different or I get to act different. But how many people are in it because they realize they need a heart change? As a matter of fact, since we're already into this, you know, numerical thing, 42 encampments, 42 stages, is equivalent to this word in Hebrew, Lamed Bet Yud. Lamed is 30, Bet is 2, and the Yud is 10. And that's Levi, not the tribe, my heart. So what was he trying to do through those 42 stages? He was trying to bring a change in their heart, a progression of changes in their heart. So when they get to the land and they see all the impediments, they see the fortified cities, they see the giants, they see all of these people that even the Creator describes as being great and strong and cities reaching up into the heavens. Nevertheless, he says, but you're not to fear them. You're not to be afraid of these things. Mark was sharing something with me last night. It was incredible. And I guess you already know, but it was about the mustard seed, that kind of faith. I was like, that's fantastic. All right. So that kind of a faith, to have that other spirit like Caleb did, to know that he said it, he's eternal, therefore we can do it. We can walk in. We can possess this land. Nothing will stop us from doing this. They didn't have that kind of heart starting out. He had to bring them through all of this stuff. Some of it he orchestrated. Some of it was the result of their bad choices. Nevertheless, he brought them through all these stages that were to provoke a change in heart. So when they got to the threshold of their destiny, they would believe him when he said, don't fear them. Don't be afraid of them. If you're going to fear anybody, you better fear me. If you're going to dread anybody, you better dread me because I am eternal. And so he brings about that change of heart. It's interesting to me that the 14th encampment or stage in Numbers 33 is Ritma. Ritma. This is the place where they were when they got the idea, let's send some spies into the land and let's see how we're going to take the land. And the Creator agreed to this. And so he takes princes of their tribes. And you know the story. They go into the land and they collect the fruit of the land. They went to the Valley of Eshkol. Were you with us on that one when we went to the Valley of Eshkol and had all, okay. I mean, they're still growing stuff there. Pretty impressive. But anyway, they bring back the fruit of the land. And they tell the people, hey, it's just like Moses said. It is a land flowing with milk and honey. Look at the fruit of the land. But there's something that Moses didn't tell you. That there are people over there. We saw the Anakim there. He didn't tell us about that. We were like grasshoppers in their sight. We saw their fortified cities that reached up into the heaven. And even though their description of the land is accurate, they didn't say anything that wasn't true. There were the Anakim there. There were fortified cities. They had all of those things. And yet, their report is called evil. Why? Because it allowed fear to grow in the hearts of the people. It allowed doubt to grow in the hearts of the people. To come to the conclusion that all of the things that the Creator has done for us to bring us out of Egypt by the blood of the Lamb, to open up the sea so that we can walk through on dry land, to feed us with manna every day, to split a rock so that we are all watered. All these things that He's done, our shoes aren't wearing out, our garments aren't falling off of us. All of these things that He's done for us in times past, He just brought us to this point to kill us. That was their attitude when they heard this report. And of course, I know that we would not think that way. We have never felt that all the things that He's done for us in times past, we get into a certain situation, well, this is where it all ends, you're just going to kill me. So He puts us in situations to prove us. Is it in your heart to do this in spite of? Is it in your heart to do this even if things aren't going the way you think they should go? Because it's going to be those people who do those things in spite of the stages that we're in, who will be standing on the bank of the river when it's time to cross over into the land. They will be the ones that will walk into it, and if this is the right word, the destiny that the Creator has for this generation. It will be those ones who grow through those stages, that they recognize that this is not a change of scenery He's bringing me into. This is something He is using to provoke a change in my heart. Maybe I don't understand exactly what it is right now, but if I'll keep my focus on Him and keep putting my heel in the impression that His has left, He will bring me to the realization of understanding what this stage in life is all about. So it was at Ritma that they heard the evil report, and as a result, they don't enter the land. All right, let me see how I want to do this. 42 stages. That number jumps out in my mind because in the Gospels, in the lineage of the Messiah, there are 42 generations from Abraham to the Messiah. From Abraham to David, 14 generations. From David to the Babylonian captivity, 14 generations. From the Babylonian captivity to the Messiah, 14 generations. 14, 14, 14, 42. So apparently there's something about this number 42 that the Creator somehow or another wants us to take note of. And maybe, again, it's about the change in heart. Look into Abraham, your father. Look back to his example. I called him and he was the only one. But I blessed and multiplied him. And from him came this boy named David, who, by the way, wasn't scared of the giants. At Ritma, what were they afraid of? The giants. They would not cross over. From Adam, 14 generations ahead, you come to a man by the name of Ever. Ever. Ayin Beit Choresh. Ever. And from that word we get Ivrit, or Hebrew. Avram was a man who crossed over from Babylon into the land. He heard the voice. He followed. He went on this journey. He went to a place he didn't even know where he was going to initially. But he crossed over and he became known as Avram HaIvri. Abram the Hebrew, the one who crossed over, who had the courage to go into the same land that unfortunately his descendants later on would not have the courage to go into. 14 generations from him, you come to David, who again took that stone and he went up to the giant because he recognized that giant doesn't have any protection. He doesn't have any covering. He's uncircumcised. Spell it, is Yud Dalet. Does anybody know what that word is? Yad. Hand. And what is the implication? It's the hand of the Creator. He sets his hand to do something. Reverse those letters. It's Dalet Yud. That spells the Hebrew word die. When we have the Seder, we come to a particular place where we say, if he had only brought us out of Egypt but had not caused us to pass through the sea, dayenu. If he had only opened up the Red Sea and caused us to pass through but had not given us the Torah at Mount Sinai, dayenu. It would have been enough. And so that's what the word die, dalet yud, means in Hebrew. It's enough. And so there are times that the Creator says, okay, at this stage of your life, you're going to be here for a while until I say, die. It's enough. And then you're going to pull up tent pegs and you're going to move to the next station. And by the way, you're not going to go back to that one. You're leaving that one because it is enough. And you're going to go to the next one. And you're going to be in this stage for a while. It might be months, it might be years, but you're going to be at this stage until you learn, until you grow, until your heart change occurs, okay? Until he says, die. It's enough. And then you're going to go to the next stage. But isn't it interesting that the Hebrew word die phonetically is the same as our word, D-I-E? Because what is that stage all about? Dying to ourselves. And so the hand of the Creator moves upon our lives to bring us. Sometimes he leads us, sometimes he drives us, but he moves us from one stage to the next stage to the next stage. And when we finally die, he says, die. It's enough. It's time to move on to the next stage. This is just a random thought. You'll have to just, this is how I think. Of course, 15 is Yud-Heh. Yeah. The hand, what's implied is it's the hand of Yah. It's the hand of the Creator. 14 and 15. And when I was a kid, I was probably, 8, 9, something like that. And I walked out of the church one night. It was a Sunday night. I walked out of the church into the parking lot, and I was just looking up in the night sky and looking at the stars, and I just really felt like God was speaking to me about some things. I can close my eyes, I can see it all again, and I can hear him speaking to me and the things that he spoke to me. And it was kind of weird, but one of the things that I felt like he spoke to me says, always be aware of the 14 and the 15. And I was 8, 9 years old. I'm like, what's that all about? So I grow up, you know, and start seeing some things in Hebrew, and I remember that. Always be aware of the 14 and 15. And so I started recognizing that there's some oddities in history that maybe have something to do with this. For instance, and this is kind of, I'm taking a little sidebar here. I'm going to bring it back to the main trail in just a second. But like the RMS Titanic, for instance, struck the iceberg on April 14th, but sank on April 15th. Lincoln was shot on April 14th, but died on the morning of April 15th. David Ben-Gurion announced the birth of Israel on May 14th, but it didn't take effect until after midnight on May 15th. We eat the Pesach, or we prepare for the Pesach on the 14th, and unleavened bread begins on the 15th. And so there's on and on and on. There are these things where you see the hand of Yah. What I heard today is that in the midst of these stages that we really would rather not have to deal with, nevertheless, we see the hand of Yah. We see the hand of the Creator moving us as individuals, as families, as a congregation. I don't know if you remember or not, but a couple of visits ago, I told you, I sensed that this congregation, he was going to be taking you into places that he was going to use you as an example. And I still believe that. We can't lead people where we haven't yet journeyed. And Mark and Tammy were sharing with Beth and I last night about the just the amazing testimonies that have come out, just how he has used this awful, awful tragedy yet to speak into the hearts and lives of people that maybe, who knows, would have never taken a listen, who would have never stopped and paused to want to know what's going on at that little building over there in Newsdale. Sitting over there in the chair, and I was thinking, you know, Father, what in the world can I possibly say? And 45 minutes or whatever that you can't just do in an instant. And the answer to the question is, there is nothing I can say in 45 minutes that he can't say and do in an instant. And yet, nevertheless, he chooses to use me, he chooses to use you, he chooses to use us all. He could bring the nations down just like that. He could be sitting upon his throne tomorrow. He could wipe out all the things that are evil and wicked in this world. He could bring it down in an instant, and he could institute righteousness and justice right now. And yet, he chooses to use people like you and me to bring us on our journey individually and collectively, to bring us from station to stage to that particular encampment, to change our hearts through us. That's how he brings these things to pass. And I believe with my whole heart that we're living in a day and time. Things are getting ready to happen on the world scene. And it won't necessarily be the Donald Trumps of the world who are affecting the change that he wants to bring about. When the collapse happens that we're discussing, the restoration that is to come will not be through the politicians necessarily and the mighty men of this world. It'll be through John Q. Average. It'll be through you, people like you and me who have walked this journey, who've been over here in obscurity, so to speak. And yet, through people like you and me and our brothers and sisters around the country and around the world, he's raising up a nation to be a light and an example to all of those people who have no idea what's getting ready to happen. But we can't leave people where we haven't been. So we go from stage to stage to stage to grow, to mature, to have a change in our heart. Well, I'm going to just pause there. And I think we're going to come back after lunch for those of you who can. But that's what's on my heart this morning. And I want to thank the Creator for allowing me the opportunity to be here with you this morning.